This is a report of interview with Captain C.P. Nixon, Royal Canadian Navy, brackets retired, close the brackets, in Victoria, British Columbia. You're on your... You come out to the West Coast every 2 years, I think, Pat.
Well, I've been revisiting what was my boyhood home, where I did my schooling in Victoria and at Shawnigan Lake School and Victoria College, which was then part of the University of British Columbia. And then I joined the Navy in 1935. And as often happens, the last place the military would send you would be your own hometown. And I never had an appointment ashore on the West Coast, but I did for a period of a year. Immediately after World War II, I was in command of the destroyer Crescent, based at Esquimalt. But of course, we were away most of the time.
To go back, I usually start with questions of when did you join the Navy and why. You've already answered both. You told me when, and I know why. Don't let this embarrass you, but your father is very revered by all that generation that served under him. So will you go back and talk about how your father came into the Royal Canadian Navy?
Well, my father was of the southern Irish gentry, and as many such families did, they, because of the non-industrialized nature of the country, it was a good career to go into the Army or the Navy, which many of them did. And in 1892, he was born in 1878, in 92 he joined the Britannia as a cadet in the Royal Navy, and he served all around the world, and he got, as people did in those days very often, he got involved in one of the colonial wars in Somaliland, and had the East African General Service Medal with a bar that read Somaliland 1901-1904. And then when he was about 30, a little over 30, he heard that the Canadian Navy was going to be established, and further that they were going to have a college to train cadets for that Navy, and he applied to be in charge of it, and he was in due course selected from other applicants to get this posting, and so he had visited Canada before, and some of his ancestors had seen service in Canada too, and so he duly arrived in Halifax in 1910, and shortly thereafterwards married a Canadian from Quebec City. And
did you tell us your mother's maiden name?
My mother's name was Porteous. They were a Scottish family who came to Montreal in 1763, just after the conquest, and they were mostly merchants and bankers, and my grandfather made a lot of money as a financier, and
it was on your mother's side,
yes,
in Montreal, yeah.
Yes, and he had a beautiful house which is now an institution on the island of Orleans near Quebec City, and he had another house in Nassau, in Bahamas, which was bought by wealthy Americans. But he had 11 children and many descendants, so that the pie of his fortune went into quite narrow slices by the time they got back down to me.
Have you got a family tree?
Yes.
Have you?
I'm the
Alfie Wertle showed me his. It goes on. It's so long. Yours goes back to where, then?
Oh, my family. I'm the historian of my family, and the Irish side, who were originally from the Scottish border and went in Elizabethan times to Ireland, I think by popular demand because they made so much trouble on the border. But anyway, they go back to about 600 years, to 1300 and something, and one of the earlier ones was, it says, was slain by Lord somebody rather, which is obviously a very distinguished way to die. It'd be better to be killed by Lord somebody than by just a mere commoner.
That's good, isn't it? All right, your grandfather, on your mother's side, the Porteous,
yes,
came to Montreal as a young...
Well, no, his family had been in Montreal for since the 18th century, you see.
Oh.
And twice married into French families.
Yeah.
The first was a French-Canadian family who, surprisingly, in the 1770s, they married into a French family, and she changed her religion to Protestant, which was unusual. And the next generation, they married into a French family, a Français de France, who'd come to left France in a hurry at the time of their revolution and come to Quebec City in the late 18th century. But they were Huguenot French, so I used to have a rough time with the Roman Catholic padres in the Navy, because I could honestly say that my father came from Ireland, from the south of Ireland, my mother came from Quebec City and was part French, and they were both Protestants, and they could, so that was very difficult to explain.
That would upset the RC padre, no way. What did you do when you were a young officer with Fallout the Roman Catholics? Well, what are you?
So
it's nothing to do with this tape, but let's find out.
Yeah. Oh, I
we discussed this once in headquarters when I was working for you.
I'm an Anglican, but actually, on my father's side, there were Church of Ireland, which is the Episcopal Church in Ireland.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were clergy in the Church of Ireland, and my father's Porteous side, they were originally Presbyterians, but they somewhere along the line they became Anglicans.
Yeah. I never fell out with the Roman Catholics when I got command, and Fanny Bidwell said to me, I told him that, and he said, you should, you know, you'll get into trouble with the church for not doing it. I said, well, I won't really, because I'm a Catholic, and I say Catholic prayers, and the not a Hail Mary or anything, but the Protestants don't notice it, so it's all right. He said, well, good. But it's a good thing, is it not, that the troops are not falling out now, I think. I always thought that was divisive.
Much better. I believe in ecumenicism. I've through the Order of St. Lazarus, of which I'm presently Vice Chancellor, ecumenicism is one of our things, and I personally haven't the slightest objection to attending Roman Catholic services and Mass, and often have done so, it doesn't worry me in the slightest, even though I suppose I am by conviction a Protestant and always will be, but I do believe in not living in separate watertight compartments.
And I think the Navy was on to ecumenism long before whichever Pope, I get mixed up with my popes,
John the 23rd.
John the 23rd did it, because the Catholic chaplains and the Protestant chaplains always got along extremely well in the service.
Yes, they did.
We better get back.
The sea and ships.
Now, you're no relation to the engineer Porteous.
No.
You say with some relief.
No. Well, I suppose the same Scottish clan originally, but no known relation. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there was this paymaster commander, Nixon, Francis Nixon, who was lost at sea in World War II. He was also no relation. It just happened to have the same name.
Your father must have been chosen from a very large list of applicants.
Well, I believe he was. And he died a heartbroken man, because his college, naval college that he'd built up for 11 years was, for political reasons, was closed. My mother used to say that it probably would not have been closed if it had stayed in Halifax, but since it was wrecked in the Halifax explosion in December 1917, they had to find new quarters for it, and they moved it to Esquimalt, which had little political clout in those days, and I think if it had stayed in the Maritimes...
It would not have been closed.
It would not have been closed. It would have been sacrosanct and protected, but there it was, however, my father was well remembered. They named a building at Royal Roads Military College, the Nixon Cadet Block. It was opened by the Princess Royal in 1955, and my mother was there, and for quite a few years the ex-cadets of the old Naval College, they donated to an annual award to the best cadet from Royal Roads called the Nixon Memorial Sword of Honor. Mm-hmm. So I think he was respected and well remembered in the long run.
Well, I've spoken to whoever I've had interviews with from that first Naval College, and they all speak of your father with a mixture of admiration and respect, even love and respect, and that's all a man can ask, isn't it?
Yes, it's very nice. And it's been he died when I was only 7 years old, so I just remember him, but it's been a pleasant feature of my life has been exactly what you just said, how people have often said nice things to me about my father.
Well, the only Hugh Pullen gave an after dinner speech at a Halifax NOA dinner, and it was a dreadful speech. You know, Hugh was a very lovable man, but he was a dreadful public speaker. Yeah. It was an awful speech. But when he wasn't the Hugh Pullen any of us knew when we were just talking to him when he was giving this speech, and even Helen was bored out of her mind with it.
Yeah.
But when he got to talking about your father, he suddenly became Hugh Pullen again, not Hugh Pullen the speechmaker.
Yeah.
And he choked up a little bit talking about how he respected your father, and it was the highlight of his speech. It's interesting what you said about and what could have been. Yes, if it had stayed in Halifax, we might never have lost our Naval College.
I think that would be the case, yeah. So, looking back on it and using wise hindsight, Monday morning quarterback, of course, it was nothing could have been more unfortunate or stupid to have closed the source of officers for the Navy at such a time with World War II coming along only 17 years later, and it's the effect of the closing of the college and the lack of properly trained officers was felt for probably for two generations afterwards.
Well, it's not only that, we'll get onto this later, but it wasn't until 1943 that the Royal Canadian Navy really got the hang of it and started to operate as a navy.
Yes.
You know, we didn't do well in those first 3 years at
all. No.
As we'll get on to. Tell me an anecdote about your father that hasn't been put into history. I don't know, you were only seven when he died.
Mm-hmm.
What was he like at home?
Well, he was had an easy sense of humor and fairly hearty manner, but he was an Irish realist. He wasn't. He was rather like an Irishman Wellington, more than like Englishman Nelson. He didn't get carried away with the sort of imperial pomposity and thoughts of empire or something. He referred to the Navy, I'm told, as being a good firm.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was rather down to earth in that sort of way, but on the other hand, he had a tremendous sense of duty, which he seemed to impart to his own staff and his officers. And there was one anecdote I did relate somewhere before, but there was old engineer Rear Admiral Stevens, George Stevens, who went from engine room artificer to engine room engineer Rear Admiral, and he when he was a lieutenant, he was on my father's staff at the Naval College, and further, when he was officer of the day, he'd report in the traditional way, rounds correct, to the captain, my father. And surprisingly, in those days, this would have been about 1920 or 21 in the Squamult, he did it by telephone. And he always used to tell me how my father would say, in the usual response, very good, in a gruff manner, and slam down the phone. A couple of minutes later, he would call Stevens back and say, Stevens, come on over and have a drink. And the old Admiral Stevens thought that was great, that the separation of business and pleasure, you know, that of duty and social occasions.
That's nice. What other military are there in your background?
Well, quite a few in the army over the years. Was one distant relative on a different branch of the Irish family of Mixon and of Fermanagh and Cavan is the name of my family in Burke's Landed Gentry. It hasn't been in Burke's Landed Gentry for many years because they haven't been landed in Ireland for a long time, but that's because the name of the family. And there were three different branches. There was one, was Sir John Eccles, General Sir John Eccles Nixon in Mesopotamia in World War I. He was a fairly well-known fellow. And the only...
Eccles Nixon is hyphenated, is it?
No, it wasn't hyphenated.
All right.
And then I had a... at home, I have a picture, a painting of HMS Bellerophon done in 1836, exactly 150 years ago, and it was commanded by Captain Horatio Stopford Nixon, who was my great grandfather's brother. And I have some letters of his. He was, for some reason, briefly in Russia, in St. Petersburg, and in those days, anybody from great outside was an object of interest, and in no time at all he was in the closest court circles and playing parlor games with the Tsar and his family, and he wrote an amusing account of all this in about 1836 or so. But then I have a nephew in the Navy serving today as a lieutenant commander, Robert Nixon, my brother's son, and then I have in the Royal Navy I have a son of a first cousin, Captain Charles Nixon Eckersall. They hyphenated his name by...
Did you spell that second name?
E-C-K-E-R-S-A-L-L. It was one of my father's names also. Captain Charles Nixon Eckersall, he's a senior captain, a man of, I guess, about 47 or 8, and in command of a brand new ship, so he's a submariner, so he seems to have had a good career.
I've got to ask you to go back, otherwise Alma and I will be searching the map of Ireland. Where did you say your family... Would you spell where your family are from?
Well, the two counties, Fermanagh, F-E-R-M-A-N-A-G-H, and Cavan, C-A-V-A-N.
Oh, yeah.
Now one is in the north and one is in the south, but my family were South Irish gentry. They're pretty much the same kind of people as most of the literary figures of Ireland, like Sheridan and Goldsmith and Oscar Wilde and W.B. Yeats, Dean Swift, they were all Protestants, as were many of the patriots. Nothing is clear-cut in Ireland, but it was the case that you might say there were many prominent Catholic families in the nobility and landowners and everything else, but the majority of such people in Ireland in the old days were Protestants. Because they were Anglo-Irish, Scottish-Irish descent. And,
yes, of course.
And came over in various campaigns, and in the case of my family, they came in the late 1500s was when they came to Ireland, but they considered themselves completely Irish. I know in my father's generation, first, his elder brother, who was an army officer, created a sensation by marrying an English woman. And I don't know what sensation my father eventually created by marrying a Canadian, which was probably worse still.
Yes. It's a sad country.
But anyway, I've been visiting Ireland for 50 years, and I always say I haven't quite arrived at a solution to their problems, but I do believe that they must be reunited. They must become one island, one country again, because it's ridiculous in such a small place and such a very small population that they should be divided. But I've had many good times in Ireland. They're always fond of the old blood, but I wouldn't dream of living there permanently. I could even claim Irish citizenship if I wished, but My great-grandparents' house, which I visited, is now a convent. My great-great-grandparents' house, Hazelwood, County Sligo, is now a lunatic asylum.
Well, that's typical of Ireland, I think. That's typical of Ireland. Well, we better get back to you in 1935, I guess.
Yeah.
You joined...
Well, I joined the...
You wrote the civil service examinations.
Yes, in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And
you were going to...
I was at Victoria College.
College
at the time. And
but before that, you went to the boys' school,
Shawnigan Lake School.
Yeah.
Which was a very good school, very convenient for the parents. They put you in at the beginning of the term and you left at the end of the term. I never... ever recall leaving the place during the term at all.
No.
And it was a very self-contained place out in the country with a large property and so forth, and quite a healthy, fresh air sort of place. I think its nearest equivalent in the east would be Lakefield School, which I visited, is somewhat the same.
No. Because the Navy drew a lot of officers from Shawnigan Lake School and Lakefield when war was declared.
That's right.
Craig Campbell, I think, went to Shawnigan Lake.
Craig Campbell was there when I was there. Mickey Sterling was there. Robin Hayward was there. Probably others I can't think of.
So,
and many served in the Navy during the war, who are now lawyers or stockbrokers or something in Vancouver. Most of the boys came from either Vancouver or Seattle, and we sometimes had games, or more often a fight, of island versus mainland, and we islanders were a mere handful. We were like the Athenians taking on the Persians at Thermopylae or something.
The same sort of skylarks you used to have in the wardroom afterwards.
Yes.
Yeah. So you joined as a cadet and went where?
And we went straight to England to spend a year in the British cruiser Frobisher, and we were the same, and we had the same training as the British naval cadets. We were considered the equivalent of their special entry or public school entry, people who had finished high school in our terms, but also in the training ship, half the cadets had joined the Navy again in our terms at the beginning of high school and had spent those years in Dartmouth, and then at the age of 17 they all went to sea in this cadet training cruiser, which was and we sort of lived the life of seamen and only put on our officers' uniforms in the evening as a rule, or when we went ashore. The rest of the time we were in a seaman's jersey and an open neck sweater and navy blue flannels, and spent a lot of time in boats and scrubbing the decks and that sort of thing, and doing our classes in between. And we had seven in our group, one of whom failed the exams at the end of the first year as cadets, and another one was killed in the war, but the other five all had careers as regular officers in the Navy.
Those five were?
And they were David Groose.
Yeah.
Who was finished as a captain and was later a member of Parliament. And then we had John Ansley, who was first lieutenant of the Haida in all her actions in the English Channel in 1944, and he retired as a lieutenant commander after over 20 years' service. And then there was myself, who was in the Navy from 35 to 65, retired as a captain, and then we had... The other three were all marine engineers. Two are still alive, Commander Jeffrey Phillips and Commander Dennis Forster. And the third one, Theodore Izard, was killed in the war in the Athabascan. And I remember when we arrived in London, we were sent to Canada House. And they produced an official from Canada House to give us a little talk on how to conduct ourselves in this strange country. And I was very impressed with the way this was done, because the person who gave us our briefing was none other than Colonel Georges Vanier, who was on the staff there, and so I was never surprised that he went on to greater things afterwards.
Yes, and he had a son, Jacques Vanier, in the service.
Yes, I didn't know him, but...
I served with him in the carrier. He left to join the priesthood,
yes,
as a sub-lieutenant, and now he's working with...
Relac.
Well, I have to call them... It's not the proper term. Retarded adults is what he's working with.
Yes.
Because in France, when he was there, he noticed that the retarded children received all the help they needed, but at a certain age, they were just put out. So he started a little community for them, and that's what he's still doing today.
Yes, anyway, as a young cadet and midshipman when I was there, I had you asked me about any members of my family in the Navy. I thought of another one who I never knew, because he died about the time I was born. He came from Rothsay, New Brunswick, and was a first cousin of my grandmother, and he finished up as Admiral Sir Charles Drury, and he was second Sea Lord under Jackie Fisher in Edwardian times. And his widow, who I addressed as Cousin Amy, Lady Drury, she lived in a lovely Georgian 18th century house in Kent. She lived alone with 12 servants in the house, and it was fun to go and stay there with other young Canadian cousins who were hanging about in England at the time,
yes,
including two first cousins of mine right from Victoria, James Piddington, who was killed in the Air Force.
Pittington?
Yeah, Pittington. And he was killed in bomber command over Hamburg in 1943, and his younger brother, Peter, was killed as a midshipman in the Royal Oak. Anyway, we as young fellows, we had fun going and staying with Cousin Amy in her gorgeous house called Homewood, Tinterton, Kent, which is now a school.
You went from the briefing with Colonel Vanier to the cruiser then?
Yes. And we were in the cruiser for a year. It was divided into three cruisers. The first cruise was supposed to be in the Mediterranean, but the Italian-Abyssinian War was going on at the time, so we never got there, and as a result, I didn't get to the Mediterranean until many years later, when I was second in command of the aircraft carrier Magnificent in the 1950s. So instead of having a nice Mediterranean cruise, we went round the north of Scotland, and lots of rather unattractive weather and so forth.
Yeah.
That took us till Christmas, and then after Christmas we set out for and had a wonderful cruise in the Caribbean, and were also in Madeira, and through most of the British islands in the Caribbean, and we were also likewise in Puerto Rico, which was then very much an American colony, rather not unlike a British colony in the colonial life of the officials there. And then we did...
Excuse me, who was the cadet gunner?
Who was the cadet gunner? We first of all had a man named Archer, and then we had a man named Marjo, M-A-R-J-O-T.
How were those... They were the ones that ran the cadets. Talk about the both of them for a minute, will you? I want to get the feeling of what it was like to be a cadet in those days in that ship.
Well, the cadet gunner was certainly a key person, and as were one or two chief petty officers under him who allotted us to our various duties and so forth. But I think the person who made the greatest... impact on me was our divisional officer, and they divided the cadets up in the traditional way of forecastle, main top, foretop, and quarterdeck, and in the main top division it was in the charge of a lieutenant commander, Philip Curry, and he was well chosen to train cadets. He was a fine professional officer, one of these people who was just too young to have been in World War One. And I remember as young officers, we had a rather sneaking regard for these fellows who instead of having their medals from World War One and hiding behind the Battle of Jutland, they really had to know their stuff and make up for the fact that they hadn't in fact had any wartime experience, and they tended to really be better professional officers than some of the ones that are just a little bit older than themselves. And he was one of them, and he had a good career and finished up as a rear admiral.
It's my impression, do you confirm it, that the RN chose their training officers with care?
I believe they did. Yes, they of course had a very large navy and a lot of people to choose from in those days, and most of the officers, I think, were in the training crews were probably a cut above the average, as you suggest.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's also my impression that captains in the Royal Navy spent a great deal of time with junior officers.
Yes, well, that, of course, was an extension of a different kind of society than today. It was